This is the story of a podcast, how we are overwhelmed by the complexities of modern life, and how everyone came to believe that autism was a form of superpower. In Brooklyn, New York, and Cincinnati, Ohio, in 2016, three men set out to create a new technological fantasy. They called themselves Chapo Grey Wolves, and what they set out to do was create a new form of politics that would blend the Dadaist comedic absurdity of weird Twitter with the ideas of Islamist thinker Sayyid Qutb through the medium of podcasting. But while the out-of-touch politicians slept, a powerful new ideology was beginning to form, one in which irony was good, where family court was bad, and whose leaders promised triple-digit orgasms in a renewable fuel source and miracle cure in the form of the sugar substitute stevia. But a strange thing happened after these men began to pretend to hate sex and masturbation. The more they joked about it, the more the young technocrats realized that being voluntarily celibate was in fact not a joke. Their aim was to create a new world, one which pitted those voluntarily celibate against those who had no choice in their own abstinence. But what the politicians didn't realize was that they had ceded control to a dark and dangerously simplified version of humanity, in which people could be classified and their futures determined simply by whether they were capable of having sex. Meanwhile in Turkey, President Erdogan had a different vision, one in which he could use this strange new utopia to get revenge on his former colleague turned rival.
That was my little tribute to Adam Curtis to open up this new show. Adam Curtis, whose new movie, Hypernormalization, came out this week, and I watched it all instantly. If you know Adam Curtis, please ask him to come on the show. This is Chapo. Let's go. Hey, it's me again, your boy Will Meneker here. We got a great interview for this week. It's a long one. We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, and we take a long, deep dive into the nation of Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and the abyss of U.S. foreign policy. Just quick note about this interview. It is just myself and Felix talking to Jeremy this week. Unfortunately, no Matt. He had to be called away. The treats were calling him, and we couldn't get him this week, but he is still with us in spirit, and we'll be back soon. Oh, and also real quick, shout out to Chris Person for contributing some of the writing to that Adam Curtis cold open. Let's roll that interview with Jeremy Scahill. Cheers. We're here with Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept. How's it going?
It's great to be here in the house.
It is indeed a house.
When I was telling some of the people at First Look who are like in charge of trying to create podcasts, they were like asking me what podcasts I listen to, and I actually don't really listen to that many podcasts, but I mentioned your podcast, and the look on their faces was like sour, and they thought I was like messing with them, like it was like a Chapo Guzman's podcast. It's not a very NPR vibe.
We're gonna use that as a blurb when we launch the website. That's an interesting podcast. The Intercept.
No, not The Intercept. Okay. Intercept is cool. You have fans there.
The blurbs are, it plays. People are talking on it. It's on iTunes.
Well, the thing with when First Things,
they like us too.
Yeah, they're huge fans.
But what's amazing to me is that, you know, First Things, I wrote about First Things back when I wrote the book on Blackwater.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, just like I'm sure everybody that listens to the show knows the story, but First Things is this like really radical right-wing Christian supremacist rag that's been around for a very long time. And they launched this really amazing attack on you guys. That was like, you could not have written a better satire of First Things. It's like, listen, Youngs, don't listen to these dangerous people.
They repurposed the article that they wrote about Louis Louis in the 1960s.
First Things, like I wrote about them because in the 90s, when you know, that radical revolutionary Bill Clinton was president, it kind of coincided with the rise of what we now refer to as like the radical religious right, or the, you know, sure, the Republican Revolution with Newt Gingrich on like marriage number 14, and everything was like the Speaker of the House. But there was this part of the way that they got that the Republicans got the evangelical Christians into their camp is that they realized it was a huge voting block of people that traditionally weren't voting. And so they basically manipulated their own agenda to fit into the evangelical conservative way of looking at the world. And so they made all these concessions to them on issues like, you know, abortion, mainly on social issues, and really pumped this idea that Clinton had, you know, implemented a secular dictatorship. And so in an issue of First Things magazine, they had a forum where they were sort of discussing how to deal with the dark era that they were in of Clinton's secularism. And they actually sort of opened themselves to the question of, should there be a revolution against Clinton to like overthrow this secular regime? I mean, I know we're going to talk about Yemen, but it's like these guys kind of know, you know, civil war stuff and like proxy wars and everything. And so when I saw them, the attack about you guys, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Chapo Trap House is connected to Eric Prince, who's good friends with the people that ran First Things, that contemplated a revolution the last time a Clinton was in power.
The last thing we want to do is to upset the Ayatollah Council of America. I was like previously on good terms with him.
What's kind of amazing about Trump is that, like, usually Max Blumenthal wrote this book, Republican Gomorrah, years ago, and the thesis of that book was basically that that religion has been used by like these vile, immoral individuals to sort of like hit a reset button on life. It's like, oh, fucking a, you know, 19-year-old dude in a car when you're on meth and you're a senator, no problem, just say you found Jesus. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's erased and you're back again. I mean, that's how people like Newt Gingrich and Ann Coulter, who, like, when they talk about family values, it really is insane because they've had multiple families and they clearly don't value them. And so, you know, you have this situation where Donald Trump clearly has not even read the Bible. You know, he was Corinthians, but he's like, you gotta know.
This is my favorite. This right here. Why? Like, kisses the Bible.
Numbers is a great book. Great book.
Love it. Perfect.
Job is a loser.
Wrong. But that magic pill hasn't worked for him. Like, he couldn't just, like, the find Christ thing really didn't work for him.
But wait, it doesn't need to work for him, because I thought, like, tons of evangelicals are supporting him anyway. Like,
well, look, I mean, look at this thing that's going on at Liberty University. You know, where all these
students,
and like that's like creepo central. Like those are like the most warped, fucked up, scary young people in America. And even they are like, no, Trump is the devil and the Antichrist.
But like, didn't Trump, like, in terms of the Republican Gomorrah and vis-a-vis at least the evangelical base, like, who up until, you know, what, like, the starting around the 70s and 80s were largely apolitical. I mean, hasn't this all just given the lie? Like, hasn't he made this sort of Republican establishment realize how little these people actually care about, like, Burkean conservatism or, like, small government or things like that? Like, they just want that kind of resentment, like, just shoveled
right
into the coal fire.
The sort of make work bow tie institutes of the conservative welfare apparatus, it's kind of like their time in the sun from, like, you know, the early 90s until, I guess, now, it was like Philip Green in Casino, where they're like, they thought they got all that money because they were so fucking smart. You know, they thought that they were selling all these voters on Austrian economics and all this shit. And you see the same thing with the evangelicals. John Dolan had once said this thing that evangelicals don't really believe in God, but they worship God as America. And Trump did kind of call their bluff when he gets up there and he's like, Deuteronomy, whatever. It's all of it's good. And because these people like worship resentment and American exceptionalism, they're like, yeah, fine, I'll go with that.
Right, right. Well, like when the founding fathers wrote the Ten Commandments. Yeah. No, but actually on Yemen. Let me tell you youngsters a tale before. It's a time before Hillary Clinton personally shot Bin Laden in the face.
Were hosting the Celebrity Apprentice, I was Zero Dark 30-ing America's number one enemy.
Donald, when you were out with Marla Maples, I was dismantling the Haqqani network personally.
It's like the 9/11 truthers where it's like Dick Cheney personally fired an RPG at the plane. The Hillary Clinton version of that is basically that she like was SEAL Team 6. That she
was like Seagal in Under Siege. They drummed her down to being a cook on the ship.
Actually, she's like Seagal in Executive Decision. Because it's advertised like she's going to be in the movie, but then she just goes away after the first 15 minutes. She was on the helicopter and they were like, we're going to crash. And she's like, I will. You won't. And just shuts the escape hatch.
But what's kind of incredible in the context of what's going on in Yemen right now, well, in a sea of like shockingly horrifying things, is how little it's talked about in even in smarter news organizations are not really covering it with any nuance. And part of the reason for that is that almost no one has reporters on the ground. But also, I sort of liken it to what happened in the 90s during the civil war in Yugoslavia, where it's like either you understand the history of it or you don't, and that's going to determine like what the strength of your analysis. And you know, it's a real. These are really complicated countries, and Americans don't do history good. And I think that, you know, it's really important for people to understand the role of Hillary Clinton in creating this current massacre in Yemen. You know, when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, you know, first of all, this is someone who is, you know, American equivalent of of someone from a monarchist family. I mean, the Bushes and the Clintons are the closest thing we have to like royal families in this country, and they're people that are very close to what we can call maybe the parallel shadow government in this country, the unelected bureaucracy that runs the CIA and the military and various intelligence agencies, no matter who's in power, and they can wait out any elected official.
Deep blue state.
Right, deep blue state. Yeah, well, and a lot of it is, you look at it, Admiral William McRaven, SEAL Team 6, registered Democrat, Stanley McChrystal, registered Democrat, Chris Wallace of Fox News the other day, although I wouldn't compare him to a Navy SEAL, but he's like the opposite of Navy SEAL.
He's better.
I consider him, he's a deficit warrior. Yeah. That's even greater than a SEAL.
Yes. Whose podcast are you preparing for? To understand, so when Hillary Clinton comes in as Secretary of State, because of her time in the Senate, but more importantly around Bill's administration and the fact that she watched how they orchestrated a variety of, you know, democratic wars, the sort of military humanitarian operations that they prided themselves on doing, she came in knowing how to sort of wax the wheels of the bureaucracy. And as a result, she presided over a pretty substantial paramilitarization of the State Department. And, you know, historically, the CIA and the military and U.S. embassies had a strained relationship in the aftermath of the 1970s and the exposing of
the Church Committee,
Committee and the House Committee on Political Assassinations. Rumsfeld and Cheney, when they were in power, had done quite a bit to kind of smash any kind of friendship between the military and the CIA. Rumsfeld wanted the war prosecuted in a certain way in Afghanistan. The CIA had a different idea. Rumsfeld basically cut off the CIA's pipeline of access to special operations forces. And that spurred a kind of turf battle that endures to this day, where the CIA started then redeveloping its own paramilitary capacity, primarily using contractors. And then the military started to build up the infrastructure of what started to look like a CIA-style global human intelligence program, setting up shops in a variety of countries around the world where they were running assets the way that the CIA does. And you had plainclothes, undeclared military personnel in a growing number of countries starting in about 2002, 2003.
This is JSOC. This is what you've written about extensively.
Right. Yeah. It's the Joint Special Operations Command, which is that in and of itself, there's a fascinating history there. But the relevant to this conversation, you know, the way that Cheney and Rumsfeld viewed JSOC was as a complete wraparound to having to deal at all with the CIA for operations, meaning that they could keep it completely secret even from the State Department or from the intelligence committees, because the intelligence committees have, authority over covert and clandestine operations of the CIA. But when the military engages in those same kinds of operations, then it goes to a different sort of committee, a committee that is very used to being totally deferential to the brass. And so, you know, there was a part of it was a kind of, I would say, smart structural decision on their part. But also it was part of their radical commitment to the idea of the unitary executive, the idea that the executive branch of government should have a dictatorship when it comes to national security policy.
Okay, that was Rumsfeld and Cheney, but like, okay, so how does Hillary Clinton?
So when we go to Hillary, so then Hillary comes in to the State Department and basically tries to patch up the relationship between the CIA and the military. And by the end of 2009, so Obama comes in January of 2009, he receives, you know, these all access briefings where the generals and the heads and the admirals and the leaders of the intelligence agencies just overwhelm Obama with like all the threats, you know, that everything that could happen in this country, you know, there could be another, you know, so-called spectacular attack. We have people trying to blow up airplanes and attack American embassies. And they basically do what everyone does, and that lets them run the deck. They flood the new president with everything that possibly could go wrong as a way of justifying the continuation of their covert action programs and dirty operations, etc. Rahm Emanuel, you know, who is a horrible fuck, you know, is in on all of these briefings. You know, they call him the he's the one digit midget or the half digit midget or whatever.
He lost a finger.
He's missing his ring finger. I took a piss next to him once at the Sundance Film Festival.
Please don't tell me.
Okay, I'm not going to discuss any of his anatomy anymore.
I shook Rahm Emanuel's hand when I was 16.
Right after you took a leak?
No, well,
did you wash it?
I was in a bathroom with Rahm Emanuel.
How does this happen to
us? Slowly lifted up my shirt. it was at some Cook County Democrat bullshit. It was after the Democrats took back the House. And this is when I was like 15, 16, and I still thought I was going to be a Green Beret who is going to come back after serving in the army and destroy Republicans by their own logic. I was really happy about the Democrats taking back the House, and I don't want to talk about it.
And you had your first Rahm encounter.
I was actually excited to meet him.
Well, Rahm is in the room while, you know, when all this stuff's going on, and he really doesn't care about any of these issues. His priority, he's a, you know, hardcore partisan political operative, and his job was basically to start already thinking about the re-election. So he's hearing, you know, all of this, the threat matrix and the idea of a homegrown attack or, you know, another 9/11. And they made a decision that I think was motivated in large part by politics to basically outsource the White House policy on counterterrorism entirely to the most unsavory components of the CIA and the military. And Hillary Clinton, then as Secretary of State, her job was to facilitate what was going to be an expanding series of small covert wars in places like Yemen, Somalia. Then it started to go into Mali, Niger. They're spreading the footprint of these drone bases. And at the end of 2009, David Petraeus, who at the time was the head of CENTCOM, of U.S. Central Command, and then eventually fucked a woman that wasn't his wife, gave her some access to classified information. But he then issues this this order in his capacity as a CENTCOM commander, authorizing U.S. Special Operations Forces to begin expanding their kinetic, meaning killing people, whacking people, and non-kinetic actions, meaning intelligence. And in the case of Yemen, Hillary, the U.S. ambassador at the time to Yemen, and then the CIA station chief in Yemen, along with David Petraeus, basically made an agreement to divvy up the emerging covert wars in Yemen and Somalia. And there was some sort of a tacit agreement that they were going to operate parallel programs, but that they would coordinate with one another. And so Hillary really was the person that was deployed by Obama or deployed herself. It's really unclear who was running these things at the time, and basically set out to figure out a way to streamline these covert operations, because you're technically an ambassador in a country owns that battle space, and they're supposed to know everything that's going on inside the country. In the case of Pakistan, the former U.S. ambassador, Cameron Munter, clearly was not informed about many of the things that the CIA was doing. And that was what the CIA wanted. But in the case of Yemen, Hillary came up with a strategy to include the diplomats in the kind of war games. And as a result, you had a kind of rebranded version of what Cheney and Rumsfeld were doing, but with the veneer of sort of diplomatic, correctness about right. the whole thing.
It seemed like during most of the Obama administration, and certainly a lot of what you've written about in Yemen, it's a country on the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula, and of which, they would say there's Al-Qaeda there, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, they have training camps, etc. And for most of the Obama administration, it's been like a drone shooting gallery. They select all these targets. It's where they killed Anwar al-Awlaki. They killed him and his son, both U.S. citizens, in drone strikes in Yemen. However, I want to talk about now, this has changed, because now there's a war going on in Yemen, mm-hmm. and the U.S. is involved with it. I just want to I want to read two things from just two press clips here. These are both from last week. The first is from the New York Times. This is the paper of record from October 12th. A U.S. ship off Yemen fires missiles at Houthi rebel sites. An American warship stationed off the coast of Yemen fired cruise missiles on Thursday at radar installations that the Pentagon said had been used by Yemeni insurgents to target another American warship in two missile attacks in the last 4 days. The strikes against Houthi rebels marked the first time the United States has become involved militarily in the civil war between Houthis, the indigenous Shiite group with loose connections to Iran, and the Yemeni government, which is backed by Saudi Arabia and other Sunni nations. That's just sort of the news article. But then a day later... this is from the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is,
that's where I go for all my news.
This is speaking for the voice of a certain kind of the American ruling class. This is sort of like the mad dog neoconservatism. Yeah. But I think the first time they've even brought up the war in Yemen was a day after these cruise missile attacks. They said, quoting here now, I said this is from October 13th, a Saudi airstrike last week mistakenly killed civilians at a funeral in Yemen. By the way, mistakenly killed. They shot them three times.
I hate it when I accidentally do a triple tap airstrike in the same region.
On a funeral.
Yeah, just by accident. Right. It's like... pencils come with erasers. Yeah. I'll post a pastebin apology right. about killing these 400 civilians.
Quote, mistakenly killed civilians at a funeral in Yemen. And the White House is now leaking that Mr. Obama is rethinking U.S. support for the Yemen campaign. But the U.S. has made similar targeting errors in many conflicts, and Saudi bombings won't get more precise if the U.S. bugs out. The U.S. ought to be helping the Saudis with enough support that they can win in Yemen.
Which is... impossible. It's impossible for the Saudis to win in Yemen.
I would like to see the transcript of what you just said, Will. No. It's just word salad. I mean, it's like absolutely no understanding of the role the U.S. already is playing and has been playing for a very long time, even predating the Saudi, obliteration of Yemen.
I mean, but like I said, we've been using, Yemen has been, I don't even know, almost an uncountable number of drone strikes have been taking place in Yemen over most of the Obama administration as ostensibly part of the war on terrorism to disrupt terrorist networks, et cetera, training camps, et cetera, et cetera. Often, a lot of times mistakenly, we kill innocent people, as you've written about. But now it's become a civil war in Yemen that's now a proxy war between... basically, I don't know, Saudi Arabia and Iran, and we're on the Saudi side. Could you give us some of the background on how we got to this point?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the first drone strike that the U.S. ever did outside of the declared battlefield of Afghanistan was in Yemen, and it was in November of 2002. Six people were killed, including an American citizen from New York State. He was supposedly not the intended target of the strike, but they were said to be six people that may have had connections to the bombing of the USS Cole in October of 2000, like right as Clinton, was coming into power. And at that time, it was the single greatest, you know, terror attack against U.S. soldiers in many years, where I think more than a dozen sailors were killed on that ship. So Bush authorized one drone strike in Yemen and then nothing else in Yemen from then until 2009, when Obama initiated this covert air war. And in 2000, covert at first, and I'll tell you why, because in December of 2009, the Obama administration and Obama personally signed off on a cruise missile attack, not a drone strike, but a cruise missile attack on what the JSOC and the CIA were saying was an Al-Qaeda training facility in a small village called El Majla. And they rain down cruise missiles with cluster bombs, which are basically like flying landmines. And I mean, I've seen the after effects of cluster bombs in a number of countries. First time I saw them was in Yugoslavia when the U.S. bombed a crowded marketplace in Nice, one of the bigger cities in Serbia. And I went there after it, and it's, you know, people are shredded into, I mean, they look like meat, like ground meat. And they're one of the most horrifying weapons in terms of what they do to people. So the first strike that Obama authorized was not a drone strike, not the so-called precision missiles. It was probably the least precise weapons, and the weapons intended to shred people, to death. And so they rain it down, and they claim, oh, this is a great victory. We've killed a number of Al-Qaeda operatives. But that story, the way that it was presented in the media, was that the Yemeni government said that it had conducted the airstrikes. And the U.S. actually sent a cable to the dictator of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, congratulating him on this successful strike against Al-Qaeda. When Yemeni journalists went to the scene and photographed the missiles, that whole story was debunked, and the U.S. eventually was forced to admit that it had done the strike. Moreover, there was no one Al-Qaeda there, and they ended up killing three dozen people, including, I think, more than half were women and children. And in the film we did, Dirty Wars, we went there and interviewed one of the survivors of that massacre, but also got videos and tapes showing clearly that these were, they actually said made in the U.S. on the missiles, and we obtained all these photographs of it. So that was the first sort of the opening salvo in this.
Just wait, quick question. Why do they keep putting made in the USA on missiles? Do you think really, they would stop by the like, yes. Missiles, tear gas shells? Why do they just got to stamp that on there?
It really is remarkable, and I don't know the answer to that question, but I would love to know the answer to
ABCs
that question.
ABCs always be closing.
Right, right. Yeah, but it's right. It's well, I mean, you know, Chomsky used to have this theory that the U.S. wanted to give the appearance of like insanity in some cases to
this
sort
is the
of
Nixon, the madman,
right?
Theory.
Exactly. Yeah, and I don't know what I necessarily buy into it, but I think at times there are certainly sadistic fucks that do that on behalf of the U.S. empire. I just don't know if it's official policy. But that question is actually a very fascinating one. Why the fuck would you put this on your covert strike that you're going to let the Yemenis
exactly
take
like,
yeah,
like if it was like the mob or something, right. They would like file down the serial numbers right, on right. The piece that they used to right. Kill the well, judge.
It's like in the Waka Flocka song where he's like, no mask, just to let you know who did it.
No, they say if they come at you with a mask, they're coming to rob you.
Right.
If they come at you with no mask, you know, they're definitely coming for your life.
Same missile, same hood. Yeah. It's all good.
That campaign of, it started with the cluster bombs. But
and then it became pure drones.
Pure drones. And it's been interesting because, you know, for years we were told by the Prague Progs that we have to do this. We have to beat back Al-Qaeda in Yemen. But now, since the Houthi takeover of the capital, since the Saudi incursion, the only times in which Saudi troops do not get pushed back into their own country is when they're fighting alongside AQAP, mm-hmm. who have been able to take massive amounts of territory in southern Yemen along the coast.
Right. Well, let's break this down because, you know, if you go back, I was tweeting about this the other day. Fran Townsend, who, you know, was a Bush Homeland Security official, then she was a CNN commentator, and now I'm not exactly sure what she does. But she, if you look in the WikiLeaks cables from that era, Fran Townsend and other Bush officials would be in these meetings with Ali Abdullah Saleh, the dictator of Yemen, and he would say, you know, you need to let us use your counterterrorism funding and weapons that you're giving us to fight Al-Qaeda against the Houthis because the Houthis are backed by Iran. And the Bush people were like, no, this guy's full of shit. There's no evidence to suggest that, which, you know, it's, I'm not praising the Bush people, you know, but on this specific issue, they were right. There was no major Iranian backing. It's like the idea that, I mean, the Houthis, their slogan
they're both Shia.
Like right, they're Zaidi Shia.
The connection.
Well, so was Ali Abdullah Saleh. Yeah, he was a Zaidi Shiite from their region, and he mercilessly bombarded them with and without U.S. weaponry for six wars. You know, I mean, these guys were in a war all through the 2000s. And so the Bush people said, no, that's bullshit. And they were telling Saleh, you can't use your counterterrorism funding to fight the Houthis. And they actually thought, well, because if we do that, it could draw Iran in. The Obama people completely fell for it. And Saleh himself, if you talk to most Yemenis who really understand this situation, the current situation, they will tell you that none of this would have happened without Ali Abdullah Saleh allowing it to happen. The Houthis would not have taken the capital. Saleh is still very much in control of the internal dynamics. And he has done this throughout his 30-year history of presiding over various parts of Yemen, where he'll play both sides. He's deeply connected to Al-Qaeda people. He's deeply connected to Houthi people. He'll allow one to sort of advance while the other has to retreat. And none of it has to do with international geopolitical questions. It's all about the internal tribal structure within Yemen. And when the so-called Arab Spring uprisings happened, you know, Saleh was massacring protesters with U.S. weaponry. And he left basically because it was easier. He left power because it was easier to let someone else deal with the, you know, the rat fuck that was created there and then be a behind the scenes broker. So now you have a situation where Iran actually is starting to give certainly logistical support to the Houthis and probably military support. But the Saudis didn't just start bombing Yemen a couple of years ago. They've been bombing Yemen for more than a decade with U.S. weaponry. And they've committed some of the, I mean, the U.S. drone strikes have killed large numbers of people. The Saudi conventional airstrikes just dwarf the totality of the U.S. drone war there.
Can we just like nail down though, like what is like the genesis of this civil war in Yemen? Because I don't think I'm even sure of it.
Well, so the kind of interesting thing about the Houthis in this context is that they've never had, you know, an eye on like conquering all of Yemen. They definitely are viewed as apostates by the majority of the Yemeni population because they're a minority even within a minority. They're Zaidi Shiite Muslims, and they, you know, they practice a sort of charismatic version of Shiite Islam. They're not even, you know, conventional Shiites, and you have, you know, Yemen, which is a fairly, you know, massive majority Sunni population. Culturally, there's just huge differences, and there have been wars in between the central government, which is primarily Sunni, although Ali Abdullah Saleh is from that area of the Zaidi Shiites, which is a whole other question. I mean, he's very crafty. You know, he's like a mini Saddam. He's a very crafty diplomat, good chess player in terms of diplomacy and dealing with the U.S. And so basically the Houthis just wanted autonomy in their area. And the Saudis viewed the Houthis as a potential threat if they extended their territory far enough to allow a pipeline for Iran to have access to Saudi territory in a way that would threaten Saudi's border. And that's kind of the stated logic for why Saudi Arabia is doing this, is that if you have a foreign hostile power like Iran backing a small militia, empowering it to such a point that they could take the capital, then our security is at stake and we need to defeat that enemy. And that's the context of it, is that the Saudis have used the Houthis to justify their own military operations. And the Iranians now are using the Saudi campaign against the Houthis as a real opportunity to break into a sphere of influence they really haven't been able to, despite all the propaganda about it. Iran never really was able to break into Yemeni society.
Yeah, and there's an interesting mirror between the chain of events that led Saudi Arabia into Yemen with the level of involvement they've been in and the sort of expansion, the deep state that you've talked about in the last 15 to 16 years. The Saudi Arabia was never like an overt invade a country type place. Since the Grand Mosque seizure in 1979, when they had to take back the Grand Mosque, they couldn't even, their troops were totally unsuccessful. They had to famously bring in French and Pakistani commandos and had to briefly convert the French commandos to Islam so that they could breach the mosque. But this sort of, it was a grand humiliation, but it started this, it exacerbated this already existing policy of using proxy groups all around the world. And they were very successful at that, using different groups in different regions to, you know, strike at regional enemies and achieve their aims. But they never really had an army. They had an air force, which is where the aristocracy would go. It was like the cavalry. Mm-hmm. They never really had an army. And when they wanted to go into Yemen last year, they didn't want to go in with their own troops. They wanted
to use mercenaries.
Right. They wanted to use Pakistani troops at first, and Pakistan totally punted on that. They put it up for a vote in parliament, which, you know, who the fuck is going to vote yes on that? I want to give the I want to give the fucking Falsons all our troops. And they wanted to use troops from Oman, too. But yeah, no, they've had to use a combination of their own troops, Colombian mercenaries, even former Blackwater
too.
Guys.
I mean, you have this weird network that still exists of like former elements of Blackwater, and for a while they were operating in the United Arab Emirates, and then that's shifted over to Qatar, and you know there still is a lot of activity. Eric Prince himself now is primarily working for China and in China, but you know his colleagues are all very active inside of Yemen and in support of Saudi. But to your direct point about the Saudi military capacity, part of this has actually nothing to do with Yemen and has a lot to do with the kingdom's preservation of itself. And I think part of this is meant as a warning domestically to anyone that would rise up against the royal family. You know, Saudi Arabia is basically like a mini version of Kim Jong-un's North Korea in terms of how lockdown information is, and you have, you know, bits and pieces trickle out about uprisings and battles, but you really don't hear much about what's happening inside of Saudi Arabia unless someone escapes. And the other thing is that the kind of articulation of jihad from the people that were at the core of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula resonated with poor and rural communities in Saudi Arabia. And I think that the Saudi royals don't so much fear Yemen as a military power or really the Houthis as an existential threat, but rather the idea that their corruption of Islam is regularly being exposed, particularly in the context of all of the support that they're getting from the United States. So they do have their own geostrategic interest in Yemen, no question, but part of it is a message to anyone that dissents against them.
The most bulletproof way you can make sure that you get killed by the Saudi state is to oppose them politically or religiously. I have something being edited right now about sort of civil life in Saudi Arabia. And if you're found to be gay or you're found to be an atheist, your punishment sort of depends on who your family knows, how mad the conservatives in your town are, where you live, what Sharia judge you get. But if you speak up politically or religiously, you're fucked. And, you know, January of this year, they executed Namir al-Namir, the Shia cleric, who wasn't even sectarian. He just was a Shia who happened to speak out against sectarianism. And the biggest threat to them is any view of the world that doesn't completely affirm their own.
But they just executed a guy whose father is one of the top people in the royal family on a murder charge. But he actually was sentenced to death and executed. And you know, you wonder like, what is, was it really because he murdered his friend when they were camping somewhere, or was he sort of working with potential coup plotters? I wouldn't be surprised if we wake up one day and like huge chaos has broken out inside of Saudi Arabia. It's one of those countries that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, Ceausescu and Kim Jong-un, and you know, you could see it just happening all of a sudden. And I think the Saudis are very concerned about that. It's part of the reason why like Bahrain wanted to hire non-Muslim troops to come in during the uprisings there. They're very concerned about the idea of Muslims having to kill Muslims. And I think the Saudis are really sort of wargaming some of their emergency response plans. But from the U.S. perspective, or from the U.S. side of this, remember that John Brennan was the CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia. He's extremely close, the current director of the CIA, extremely close to the royal family. And their drone program that, you know, Brennan really sort of pushed forward in an aggressive way, has almost entirely depended on intelligence fed to the United States by Saudi Arabia and a network of shady informants connected to the former government of Ali Abdullah Saleh. And so one of the consequences of the U.S. sort of wholesale outsourcing its collection of intelligence to Saudi Arabia is that the U.S. has found itself now doing the Saudis'
bidding. Yeah, sounds like we're doing their dirty work.
And the entire GID, General Intelligence Directorate, the Saudi, it's never been like a normal intelligence collecting body. It specifically exists to preserve the royal family.
Right. They're not interested in taking out your SIM card. They're more interested in like taking out your fingernails. Brennan, seems to be okay with that. But the ironic, or actually not, it's not ironic, the kind of classic American thing going on right now in Yemen is that the U.S. is simultaneously attacking multiple sides within the war and supporting multiple sides. You have Al-Qaeda is against the Houthis, and that's been their primary goal, to eliminate the Houthis for many, many years. Way more important to them than destroying the great Satan. They want to kill the apostates. And that's like when I used to communicate with people from AQAP, that's what they would always say. Our main thing is we're going after the Houthis. We want to stop the Houthis from taking Sana'a. We want to, they're not saying like we want to blow up, a UPS plane or send a parcel bomb to a Jewish community center in Chicago. It was we want to kill all these people. So the United States is still drone striking supposedly against Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda is fighting the Houthis, who the United States are supposedly supporting the Saudis to, massacre. The U.S. is then supporting the Saudis, who are simultaneously working with Al-Qaeda on other things inside of Yemen. And it's the whole thing is really like a Henry Kissinger wet dream. It's just all Muslims killing each other, and we don't have to do anything. And it doesn't quite matter who wins at this point. It's just we'll kill them all.
It's to quote our hero, Ron Fournier, all sides do it. Applebee's Yemen.
Right. But I love the conventional wisdom warriors who know so little about so much, and they just constantly tell us how, the little that they know. And it turns out that that's also completely full of shit. And it's why, watching people like Chuck Todd discuss anything about foreign policy, it just makes my fucking head want to explode. putting Chuck Todd and Joy-Ann Reid in my living room and strapping me to a chair so I couldn't leave and having to listen to them for like 12 hours, I would find a way to like kill myself with my teeth. No, but I used to be on those shows quite a bit, and I would attack MSNBC on MSNBC's own
famously ripped
airways.
Apart Torre. Yeah.
Oh, Torre, and also Samantha Power on Democracy Now, who I believe we talked about just 2 weeks ago with Chase Madar. Once you're in, the club. Yeah. You're in the club.
But also you get this, the Obama bots, will say, what do you want, 100, 150,000 ground troops in Yemen? But like, is that all your brain will allow, that it's either drone strikes or boots on the ground? How about we shouldn't have done any of this? But had we just left Yemen alone, what actually would have happened? Would we have been able to apprehend Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born cleric who was, I think he was guilty of crimes. I think he should have been arrested. I think he should have been put on trial. He was drone struck in an empty village outside of his family's area of influence with no other houses around, and they fucking just blew him up. Why? They don't want to put him on trial. They don't want him to lawyer up and have great lawyers in the United States and try to flip the script and say to the United States, well, here's everything, that you guys did in these wars. He would know he was going to either be put to death or spend life in prison, but he damn sure would have put on a defense. And they also don't want to talk about whether or not he was an FBI informant at one point, which I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest he was.
Okay, after 9/11, he was like a guy who was like, didn't he do something with the Bush administration, like American Muslims speak out,
First of all, he was invited to be the keynote speaker at a luncheon at the Pentagon after 9/11, and he actually went to the Pentagon and gave a lecture about Islam in the world to Pentagon employees. And we got through the Freedom of Information Act some documents about that, and there's really nothing good in that cache except a document that shows the menu for that day, and one of the choices was a bacon sandwich.
Oh my god!
In a sea of bad intelligence failures in the Bush era.
Yeah.
Do you think the Iman would like mayonnaise with his bacon sandwich? Like, but if you want to apprehend him and put him on trial, then the U.S. is going to be put on trial. You know, in a way, Bill Clinton was lucky that Slobodan Milosevic died in the middle of his trial at The Hague, because Milosevic was trying to subpoena General Wesley Clark, who was the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO during the 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia. He wanted to subpoena William Cohen, former defense secretary. He tried to subpoena Bill Clinton himself. And Milosevic was a horrifying war criminal, but he was not a stupid person. And he also understood that the information he possessed about what the United States had done with him and other powers in that country, no one wants to, the U.S. doesn't want that stuff aired. You don't talk about that stuff. Same with bin Laden.
Back to Casino. This is like when Philip Green's silent partner was like, I will not be quiet. Yeah. I will not. Yeah. He's like, Jordan, they sent me to settle it out of court.
Going back to the liberals talking, liberals seem to live in this weird binary world. I mean, today, someone showed me this screenshot of this Jamel Boy tweet where he goes, you know, given the choice between not raising the debt ceiling and defaulting on debt and war with Iran, I will take war with Iran. And no, it's wait, like, what real? Fucking
yeah, yeah, he, yeah,
what
he said that. I don't know what
world?
Context. Is there a blue check mark next to that?
I don't know what context it was in, but taking...
It's like, what fucking universe do you live in that these are the choices? Like,
that's on offer.
Yeah.
But also, you know, if we actually took these issues seriously in this society, we would have, when the killing of Osama bin Laden happened, it would have been a perfect time for us to discuss who we are as a nation. I personally believe that Osama bin Laden was assassinated, rather executed. I don't believe there was any intention whatsoever.
It was like Pablo. It was like Escobar.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. It's not, you know, and we don't even know a fraction of the criminal activity that's taken place since 9/11. I mean, well, it's true of the entire American empire, but let's say just since 9/11 under both Bush and Obama. But there is no fucking way in hell that those guys were sent in there with a mission to capture Osama bin Laden. First of all, where's Obama going to put Osama bin Laden? Is he going to send him to Guantanamo? Is he going to try to make the argument he should be at a supermax prison in the United States? Does he want to fight that battle with the Republicans? But also, bin Laden would lawyer up. Bin Laden knows a lot about, well, let's say Afghanistan, the CIA support for the Mujahideen, etc. They don't want these guys on trial. And, you know, General Crazy Beans Flynn, you know, Michael Flynn, who's
my guy.
Trump's, I mean, he's amazing.
I love him.
He's, you know, he's Trump's like top guy, and he is such a bucket full of nutty, but he actually knows shit about this stuff. And he even says, you know, look, the reason that Obama wants to use all these drones is he doesn't want to have to put them in jail somewhere, because the reality is when you capture people, there are different legal statuses of them. And what do you do with a guy like Osama bin Laden? But for me, in our society, you don't judge how, like, what your values are based on, like, how you treat Michelle Obama if she's caught jaywalking. You do it on, like, a horrible, reprehensible piece of shit like Osama bin Laden, and you say, this is going to show that we actually are a different kind of nation, but we never have been.
It would be awkward, though. I mean, like, let's say that we did arrest him, it would be like the 80s action movie where they're like, God damn it, I told you he had to get a pillow in his cell. Yeah. You read him his rights, you know, like, oh, Osama's out on bail. There's nothing we can do. Osama. And then he immediately just like blows up a shopping mall or something.
It would be like New Jack City when they have Nino Brown on trial.
No, but it would have been amazing if Johnny Cochran was still alive. Johnny Cochran was bin Laden's lawyer.
If the second season of American Crime Story would have been so dope,
it'd be
though.
Fucking lit. If Prince Turkey is murky, then
no, but I do think that that's part of what we see with this horrible, vapid state. It's really particularly like stench among the Democrats. You know, they're such like sort of law and order warriors now, like O. Willis. You know, that guy.
Interesting thing about O. Willis, he runs a parody news site. But the only stock images he's bought of it are of women's feet. I'm not kidding. Like, you look up his site.
But this, what's happened under Obama, and this happened to an extent, you know, under Clinton. When I cut my teeth as a reporter while Clinton was president, and I think it's part of why I don't view the Democrats in power any differently than I view Republicans. I think they're all pieces of shit that deserve to be held accountable. And I think that, you know, this current younger generation of establishment journalists grew up in, you know, in the sort of Bush era, and they're taught to this narrative that it's like Democrats are the good guys, Republicans are the bad guys, when in reality you can draw a pretty straight line from Iraq policy, for instance, from the advent of the Iran-Iraq war all the way to the present day. Whether it's Democrats or Republicans, there's been a pretty consistent U.S. posture where it's been consistently anti-Iraqi people. But also there's just the this war has extended in Iraq since 1979. And the U.S. has been involved with it at, you know, every step of the way. Clinton, Bill Clinton, initiated the longest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam during his presidency against Iraq under the guise of the so-called no-fly zones, bombing Iraq an average of once every 3 days during the latter half of his time in office. Then you had Clinton sign into law the Iraq Liberation Act in 1998, which Bernie Sanders supported, that made regime change official policy of the United States. So it was the precursor to the blank check that was then given to Bush, including by Bill Clinton's wife, Hillary Clinton, when she, you know, supported it and said that she misunderstood. She thought that it was they were authorizing inspectors to go in, which is the biggest pile of bullshit.
Bernie Sanders, I just like to say about Bernie, yeah, yeah, he thought that the Iraqi people deserved a regime change, which I think would be appropriate.
Right. And the thing is that, like, I having spent a lot of time in Saddam's Iraq, I do think Iraq would have been a country where similar to what happened with Mubarak initially, I do think that there would have been an overwhelming uprising, and I think that the military would have eventually joined in something resembling a coup. In fact, in the month before the bombing began, in 2003, I was in Baghdad, and the rumor sort of mafia was pushing this idea, meaning Iraqi elites pushing this idea that Saddam was going to give power to Uday Hussein, like sort of on the eve of the war. And Uday was like the scary guy that like has his tiger eat people. And, but with the idea being that he kind of knew that his days were numbered and was going to look for some kind of an exit. I don't know if there was anything to it, but it was clear that they knew that their time in power was closing down. And the last time I saw Tariq Aziz, who was the deputy foreign minister and really the public face of Iraq to the world, you know, that he was a Christian and was in Saddam's inner circle going all the way back to the Ba'ath Party days.
Day ones, baby.
Right. Splish splash, I was taken aback. He was such a gangster, man. He would smoke these Cuban cigars, and he'd greet you. He'd be wearing like his military fatigues with like house slippers, and he had the amazing Run DMC glasses. I was like, every time you went in there, you're like, damn, this is the original gangster, Tariq Aziz. But he said, the last time I talked to him, and he had, in the years that I knew him, he had never said something like this. He said, you know, the Americans can overthrow Saddam Hussein. They never would say that before. Okay, he says, the Americans can overthrow Saddam Hussein, they can invade Iraq, but they will open a box they'll never be able to close, because the only thing that can counter the rising tide of Islamic, you know, fundamentalist movements is a sense of Arab nationalism. And if you look at it from a much bigger perspective, what has happened, you know, in over the past 40, 50 years in the Middle East is that the United States has been a part of systematically dismantling or crushing all aspects of what people in Western countries would consider sort of civilized institutions, secular education. I mean, in Iraq under Saddam, women worked in every job of society. You could have a taxi driven by a woman in Saddam's Iraq. You weren't allowed to say anything bad. You'd get your tongue cut out or worse. But when they destroyed the secular kind of presence or centers of power in these variety of countries, it gave rise to something that can't be manipulated in the same way as military dictatorships, because you now have multiple generations of young people born into this shitstorm that was created by their own thugs and our thugs. And they're growing up with the reality that there is a war against their religion. That's how they are believing it. And how can you blame them given the set of facts in front of them? I'm not saying that the U.S. necessarily is trying to destroy Islam as a religion. But if I was living in one of these things,
yeah,
what
would the difference be?
Right. Well,
how would it seem differently to you if they weren't?
Yes. I mean, for all practical purposes, that has been the end result, in terms of communicating what U.S. policy is. But what's happened on the micro level in a lot of these countries is that when the civil society institutions were destroyed, people turned to the forces that were able to collect the garbage, educate your kids, help you find housing, give aid to refugees. And a lot of those institutions are very radical Islamic centers of micropower. So Muqtada al-Sadr, when the Iraq invasion first happened, you know, he had the Mahdi army, and that was, you know, the U.S. was always talking about the Mahdi army. However, the most significant thing that Sadr did was to, like, collect the garbage in what Saddam Hussein cynically named, you know, Saddam City, which was this huge ghetto of Shiites in Baghdad. They started collecting the garbage. They started patrolling the streets to try to confront any kind of looting, etc. They then sent blood to the Sunni fighters who were rising up in Fallujah against the United States. Sadr's people organized a blood drive. What's the point there? The point is, Sadr, yes, he's a radical Shiite religious figure, but he speaks in the language of the street in nationalistic terms about Iraq. And that's what the United States really, I think, has destroyed in these countries. Same thing with the Taliban. In Afghanistan, by killing off the old guard of the Taliban, you have no one to negotiate with. You've created a condition where what you claimed was this horrifying terrorist threat actually would have been much more reasonable to deal with,
you know,
than the current crop of, you know, wackos and
Jeremy,
insane people.
Have you read Andrew Coburn's book about drone
yeah.
wars?
Yeah.
One of the fascinating points he makes in that about, like, the whole strategy of targeted assassination of terrorist leaders, right? Yeah. Whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere. He said, like, that the guys who really, like, study the data on this have found that every time that we take out one of these, you know, top leaders or whatever, more violence happens. Mm-hmm. And it's a similar thing happened in the drug war in South America and Mexico, where you take out these drug lords that you think are, like, you know, you cut off the head of the snake. It's a hydra. What it does, it, like, the lieutenants or whatever, it creates a power vacuum, and then they just start killing people to show that they're on top, like they have that hand on things.
As far as I'm concerned, this is like 9/11. Tony wanted our attention, fine. He got our attention. Now we wipe him off the planet.
You know that fat cocksucker says I look like the Shah of Iran? The whacker boss? I won't do that.
It's been done before.
And it was wrong then.
It just keeps happening.
That's,
yeah.
That's an excellent point. And you know, the era when the sort of groups like FARC, for instance, in Colombia, you know, FARC at its beginning had, you know, at least the sort of, they were pretending at least to have some political motivation for their actions. And, you know, eventually transformed into almost exclusively, you know, a narco trafficking paramilitary gangster squad. But there were politics at the beginning of it. And it was sort of, you know, I think it was largely bullshit, but there was some semblance of an understandable ideology that they were promoting to defend their actions. The same is true with the Taliban. Same is true with Al-Qaeda. You know, bin Laden and Zawahiri look very reasonable compared to
Baghdadi,
ISIS. Yeah, Baghdadi, yeah. Whatever. But yeah, but compared to, like, what we hear from ISIS, bin Laden would always sort of, you know, go through the process of saying, you know, we're giving you a chance to, you know, leave the, you know, get your troops out of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, and there was a sense that they lived in the modern world and understood how nation states functioned. With ISIS, there's no sense of that whatsoever. With the Taliban, you know, first of all, there's a difference between the Taliban government, which the U.S. overthrew, you know, pretty swiftly after 9/11, and that what is generically called the Taliban, meaning the insurgent groups that are fighting the United States inside of Afghanistan. Taliban government was made up of a mishmash of people, some of whom were quite well educated. I met a few years ago in Afghanistan with Muwatakil, who was the Taliban foreign minister at the time of 9/11. And he told me the story of how they tried to offer. They had bin Laden under a default sort of house arrest near Kandahar. This after 9/11, right before the United States started bombing in October of 2001. And they sent through back channels a message to the United States offering to hand bin Laden over to an Islamic country where he could be tried in a Sharia court. And they actually offered to send him to Saudi Arabia, which would have loved to chop Osama bin Laden's head off. And the United States rejected.
Well, this would have handled our problem about not putting him on trial, right?
Just right. Let which them is, do it. Which is, you know, and it's still, it would have been, that would have been a very brutal thing too. But the point that the Taliban government, and I think, I do think that those who are actually literate within that government, because you have a wide illiteracy in Afghanistan, I don't think it was insincere. I don't think it was bullshit. I think they really were thinking, fuck, man, we don't want to link our horse to this guy. And I do think they were really saying, we need to save face. Can he go be put in trial in a Sharia thing? But the point wasn't really about Osama bin Laden at that point. They wanted their war. They were going to get their war. You hand over Osama bin Laden, then what happens? Then you have to say, yeah. but you have oil deals with the Taliban government going back to the 90s, and George H.W. Bush was involved with it. The U.S. has been playing both sides of so many conflicts that you almost have no choice but to bump people off when you've decided that they're the next Hitler. Because if you put them on trial, they're going to talk shit about you, and like people might actually hear some truths about what we did.
Gaddafi is another great example of that.
We did it. We did him dirty. Look. I'm not surprised to see another dude bro from The Intercept attacking the U.S. deep state for simply being bipartisan in all these countries.
Hey, there's not Republican cruise missiles and Democrat cruise missiles. There's American cruise missiles.
I can see them. Did they say it right on them?
No. Who is more no labels than Stanley McChrystal?
Well, I loved in the Podesta emails. I mean, but besides his amazing risotto recipe, was this thing about when they were contemplating who the VP would be, and one of the choices was Admiral William McRaven.
Yes,
yes.
And it would have been like, I tweeted a couple years ago about this, saying like, I bet you any money Hillary will like try to get McRaven to be her VP, and fuck yeah, he was on the list. No, I mean, he's a gangster too. Like these guys,
I mean,
like are
his
wacky
name
people.
Alone.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's such a fucking Tom Clancy name. Like he is,
You know, he wanted to be he has a degree in journalism. And he wanted McRaven, and he actually wanted to be like a reporter, and then he decided he wanted to be James Bond. He actually said he wanted to be James Bond.
Like most reporters.
That's sad.
He's the James Bond of reporting. Who would the James Bond of reporting be today?
Michael Weiss.
Of course.
Can Mike Barnacle be like the older version of it?
Mike Barnacle is the Timothy Dalton James Bond.
I think, okay, so that makes Speech Boy 71 Felix Leiter.
Yeah. No, just the last thing I want to talk about, like back to Yemen, is back to this idea that this is as a proxy war between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Iran, which is being played up for all it's worth. Like I said, back to that Wall Street Journal thing. I'm just reading right now from Commentary Magazine, another one of my favorites. This is Michael Rubin. He says,
"Hell yeah!
Indeed, the Houthis represent perhaps the clearest example of Iranian imperialism." Can we talk about just that phrase, Iranian imperialism,
That's
for a second?
That's so good.
There's not a big enough golden toilet to put that bullshit in the world. I mean, again, anyone who knows anything about this knows that the Iranians did want to influence the Houthis. But Yemen is not Yemen is primarily a tribal organized country. And this isn't like some orientalist analysis. This is based on, you know, being there on the ground, but also knowing Yemenis from a variety of tribes and the history of how South Yemen ended up reunifying with North Yemen and sort of the British time there, etc. You have to understand a deeper history to Yemen to make any analysis or to offer any analysis about Iran's role in this. The fact is that Iran has never been able to break in to being a significant power inside of Yemen beyond sort of really superficial propaganda campaigns and, kind of sharing a set of rhetorical devices with the Houthis. But the Saudis have always been deeply involved inside of Yemen. And that goes back for a long, long time to when the British left in the 60s. You had this this sort of like fleeing of all of these wealthy individuals who were tribal leaders inside of Yemen that were backed by the British. And then they were expelled. They lost their land. Saleh gave them access to come back into the country as a way of unifying it. And so you had all of these people that had lived in Saudi Arabia, lived in the United Arab Emirates, in Qatar, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, all of a sudden coming back to a country they hadn't been to for many, many years, in some cases decades, and then reclaiming huge swaths of territory. And those people made a deal with the devil of sorts, with Ali Abdullah Saleh, to support him politically in return for him allowing them to reclaim all of this territory. And the Houthis have almost nothing to do with that story. They have their own area in a fairly undesirable part of Yemen, and they have been sort of in the middle of a lot of people's internal wars. And so the idea that the Houthis represent Iranian imperialism, I mean, the Houthis are generally an extremely impoverished people that have been mercilessly militarily attacked by both the U.S.-backed government of Ali Abdullah Saleh at the time and the Saudis repeatedly. The people that make claims like that are people that are just like reading the slogan, or people that think that like Hillary Clinton's canned speech tells you everything you need to know about what she's going to do in power. Like, it's the same level of intellectual sophistication as thinking that a politician's tin can speech is their actual agenda.
Well, it's sort of like, you know, if you're the Wall Street Journal or Commentary Magazine, like, you probably don't know what you're talking about, but it doesn't really matter. You don't care what you're talking about because, like, are you willing to say anything? Because the goal, again, is, I think, war with Iran. They want to get, like, Iran is always in their sights. That's their white whale for a lot of these.
Wrong.
You're wrong? Oh, no, it's not wrong.
No, I think if Trump were elected, I do think that there'd be a serious possibility of the U.S. doing some insane military action in Iran. The Israelis, depending on who stays in power in Israel, I mean, Israel already has done strikes inside of Iran from time to time, and they definitely have bumped off nuclear scientists. And there's questions about whether or not the U.S. has actually been directly involved with bumping off those scientists. But I don't think Hillary Clinton would contemplate an overt war in Iran. I don't see that happening.
I hope not. But I mean, I guess the point is, like, because of that, you have them urging America to back Saudi Arabia to the hilt in this what is an unwinnable conflict for them. Basically,
yeah, but also, I mean, I get what your point is, but if you look at if you step away from Yemen for a second and look at Iraq, the end result of U.S. policy in Iraq has been that the Iranians have infinitely more power and influence, and it's growing every week in Iraq than would have been fathomable 20 years ago to imagine.
And I just
so why isn't it that we're, I mean, that's actually where you have tangible evidence of the Iranians gaining military and geopolitical footholds in a strategically incredibly important country to the global oil economy.
Obviously that's why they don't want to talk about that. But, like, you know, just the idea is, like, we always hear from this certain crowd of people that they're very concerned about Iranian influence or Iranian meddling in foreign countries. And it's just like,
But think of the insanity and the lack of knowledge that's required to make those kinds of statements that you were reading. The Shiites are a tiny minority in Yemen that even Bush's people understand had no connection, meaningful connection to Iran outside of sharing the slogan "Death to America" and some propaganda campaigns. Al-Qaeda was fighting the Houthis. The central government of Yemen was fighting the Houthis. Saudi was doing covert operations against the Houthis. Who allowed the Houthis to take power? It was Ali Abdullah Saleh. So, I mean, like, is it really that the United States is so stupid that they fell for, like, Saleh's shell game, you know, and it's like, whoop, well, you didn't know the ball was in that cup? Or is there something else at play here? And that's why I think that, you know, it's not really just, it's certainly not just about Yemen and potential threats in Yemen. Iran feels like a kind of convenient punching bag on all of this. The Saudis probably there's certainly a geographic importance to Yemen for oil pipelines and the Gulf of Aden. So I'm not saying, oh, it's all about the oil, but I do think that when we actually sort of dig through everything at the end of the day, we're going to find that the reason that the Saudis really wanted this had more to do with their own internal status as the dictators of Saudi, and also their status within OPEC and the production and dissemination of oil around the world.
I do have one follow-up for that. Given that the Saudis, they didn't get really the war that they planned on for Yemen, I mean, there is something at play with them sort of restricting different views of Islam, different political ideologies that will come in and come out, and there's some of that there, but I mean, it seems like they have no way out now. There's no way out. There is no way for them to end their involvement there, and they've you know, going back to Tariq Aziz, they've opened a box that they can't contain. Mm-hmm. What is, how do you see them sort of closing out their involvement there, if they can?
Right. I mean, it you could say that this could potentially turn into like Saudi's Vietnam, except, as you pointed out earlier, Saudi is basically has none of its troops on the ground. I mean, they do have certain coordinator. You know, it's similar to what the what the U.S. was saying in Vietnam at the beginning. They have advisors there, and they have other. But, you know, mm-hmm. but like, there's only so many mercenaries that are going to want to go and do this. And certainly, the Saudis have the money to sustain it. But at what cost? And also, you know, I think that Saudi, when an uprising happens within Saudi Arabia, or if they start to experience acts of terrorism aimed at the royal family. You know, once there was a guy who had a bomb inside of his ass, who very nearly blew up the intelligence chief of Saudi Arabia. And this was just, you know, a few years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to call the question on sort of what Saudi is doing. You know, there's no way of having like an independent poll of Saudis and what they think of this. You definitely have a troll army online that, you know, they go after people.
Yeah, the moment you say something, a guy named like Lion will go, this is an internal affair, fuck you.
Well, like when the king croaked, you know, I was just like pissing all over his grave like immediately. And I like out of the woodwork, all of these, like it was like the troll factory that everybody thinks is just Julian Assange and Putin. Like, came out of the woodwork. One closing thought, though, on this whole bipartisan nature of the empire and love of war and all those things is you know, when Kissinger finally fucking croaks, then you're going to see the disgusting nature of the sameness of
these
parties. Oh my god!
Imagine, like, if I was an actor and someone told me that I had to cry, I would think of like watching MSNBC after Kissinger's death.
but it's gonna be
this like complete
the word religion. Statesman is gonna be stretched to its absolute limit.
But that's the point of all of this. It's like Hillary's appeal in the last debate to like the Republicans and independents to join with her. It's the same sick kind of thing that you're describing, where it's like, after 9/11, we better all get together and sign this blank check for George Bush. And, you know, Barbara Lee, oh, she's a fucking crazy person. And she's actually the only person that was right about all of this stuff. And like, she got death threats for standing up and opposing the authorization for the use of military force. Same thing is true in these butchers whose lives should be examined as like war criminals. It's like, he's going to get a fucking state funeral, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a love fest, and the Republicans should come and join Hillary. They want to, man. With the exception of some stuff involving, you know, domestic policy and in some circles, women's right to choose, which is a very, very fucking serious issue if Trump becomes president. Most of these people are going to support Hillary because she represents their values. It's not like, oh, Max Boot has to hold his nose and, you know, vote for Hillary. It's like, no, Hillary is your fucking kind of person, man. It's like, you know, having other people's kids fight their wars, you know.
It's, I mean, and lost the
spit it the fuck out.
Fucked up. I should have had two cups of coffee
or some liquor,
something. I should have had ketamine.
They should do the bonfire with him at Bohemian Grove. His big bloated corpse set on fire at the Bohemian Grove.
But also, can you imagine our election? We have Alex Jones, Julian Assange, Putin. It's like amazing.
Oh, did you see that? Did you see Sean Hannity the other day where he was like, WikiLeaks is great. Yeah. Free Julian Assange.
I can't wait till Sean Hannity is posting his PGP key on the show. This is a great year, by the way.
Everybody should use a Tor browser. Yeah. Sean Hannity.
You can only access Hannah Date on Tor.
Talk to me on Signal, Sean.
All right, last question. Any chance for Dirty Wars Part 2, Rise of McRaven?
Wow, that is that's an interesting question. No, I don't think there will be a Dirty Wars Part 2.
Really? Because I have a screenplay.
Oh, you
do? It's about, you know, it's about a rogue journalist who plays by his own rules, who uncovers a giant conspiracy.
That is so, like, I don't think there's been 20 movies about that in the past.
I have a prequel. I have a prequel in mind.
All right, prequel I would do.
Okay, so the journalist works for, unfortunately, now defunct site. It was called hotsoup.com. And, he does a cyber town hall with Bill McRaven.
No, I'm thinking like you need like sort of you know, a Rust Cole character.
Yeah,
he's assembling like a giant pushpin collage in like a shipping container. and then like you're putting pushpins onto a map, and then like you step back and it's like The Usual Suspects, and you realize that all the pins on the map form the baseball crank face. Yeah. And you're like, my God.
But what if I did something like not Dirty Wars, where I just went and embedded with like Max Boot and his normal life. Yeah. And like but reported on it as though it was like an amazing investigation. Yeah. Like, you know. And every morning, Boot has to decide, do I make my own Nespresso or do I go and order coffee from that cute barista at Starbucks?
I mean, think about Max. I guess I can say it now. I used to work with a guy at Live Right. We published his book.
Max and, Boot?
Oh, yeah. Invisible Armies. Yeah, his Reader's Digest history of counterinsurgency.
Invisible Armies is like, was it like a reference of like the fact that the Kagans and Max Boot like have never been in the army?
I
didn't read
the
it.
The introduction to the book, the very first page, he talks about getting in a Humvee with the boys in Anbar province and talking about the Kevlar that you put over your genitals to stop your balls from getting blown off.
I would have been right in there if I didn't have a gamer's foot. And,
but I was
sitting there in a Hummer with Petraeus.
I gotta say, a documentary made about him would be the most boring fucking thing
imaginable.
It would
be awful. Unless Herzog directed it. That would rule.
I was on Lou Dobbs' show with Max Boot once.
Oh, wow.
The green room was really weird, you know?
Wow. Well,
Lou Dobbs came out there with his crystal white fake teeth, and he was like, he smelled like Winston cigarettes, and he like, you know, sits down.
Alpha.
And I'm like, Max Boot and I are like sitting, it's almost like the Hillary Trump not shaking hands thing. Like, Max Boot could not be farther away from me. He was almost like in the bathroom of the green room, like nowhere near me. No, the green room situation sometimes is really hilarious when I'm like on to debate like a terrible person. Once I was also with Ed Koch. He called me a terrorist lover or terrorist. Yeah, he said, you really love the terrorists, don't you? During a break on MSNBC.
Oh, my God. Anyway, so yeah, I'm going to say
your green room is much better than MSNBC's,
thank you,
though.
Thank you. No, I'm definitely going to send you that screenplay, though. So, you know.
Hey, you know, I mean, you can get an agent for that shit. Yeah. Sure, no, it sounds really, really viable.
I will say this, though, in terms of green room gossip, yeah. The worst book, I think the worst book party, just in terms of how awful the spread was Max Boot's book party at the Council on Foreign Relations, which I thought was going to be awesome. I was like, oh, this God, I can't believe I had to publish this. At least I'll get a swanky party.
What was it?
It was just like
a Costco place.
It was like, yeah, like crudité and like stale focaccia bread, and then like some like beers just in a cooler, and then red and white wine. That's it.
That's that's like when I went to John Kasich's second place victory party in New Hampshire. And he seriously had like, it was a plastic tray of two types of crackers, cheese, ranch dressing, and pineapples. That was it.
Still better than when Rubio threw a pancake breakfast with no pancakes.
God, dude, New Hampshire was like, that was like my Vietnam. So many fucking catering fuck ups.
I thought you were going to say that Max Boot had like military rations there. Like, and everybody, we've closed down all the bathrooms. You have to dig a hole for your own latrine. Maggots! No.
And this would be cool if you could give Max Boot a blanket party, like in Full Metal Jacket.
Ow! Ow! Oh, no, yeah, like it was at the Council on Foreign Relations, which has this enormous townhouse. Not even a townhouse; it's bigger than that in like the East 50s or whatever. It's like Eyes Wide Shut or something. But like
the
no one's in masks.
Yeah, in history.
Yeah, but like nobody's in masks, and they have like a really shitty hors d'oeuvres spread. That's what being in the Council on Foreign Relations is like.
And no one's fucking.
Yeah, no one's fucking. Not at all. And like instead of that weird chanting played backwards, it's just elevator music played backwards. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming, man. It was great talking to you.
It was great to be in the trap house.
Please come back.
Hell yeah.
Thanks a lot, man.
Can I come back when Kissinger dies?
Hell
oh
yeah.
Oh my God.
Fuck yeah.
Or Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
We're going to have a fucking Mexican hat party on his fucking bloated corpse.
Yes.
But while the out-of-touch politicians slept, a powerful new ideology was beginning to form, one in which irony was good, where family court was bad, and whose leaders promised triple-digit orgasms and a renewable...